Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On this episode, Justine Hamilton was kind enough to come in part two of how we lie to ourselves and learning how to tell the truth about who we are. The first episode was about my talking about my relationship with women, starting with my mom, and how I learned to lie to myself about how I looked at myself through a woman's eyes. Today it's about men and my relationship with men and how I learn to look at myself through a man's eyes. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
The obvious place to start is with my dad, but I want to welcome Justine first because I really appreciate her coming here to hang out and ask me some questions.
Oh, thanks, Dana. Happy to be here again.
Good. Again, the premise of this podcast is all about the idea that I have that we learn to lie to ourselves very early in our lives, sometimes starting pre-birth, but certainly after we're born, depending on the relationships we have with the people that brought us into the world. My understanding of my father and his lack of participation in my life as a really little kid seems to make sense. He was very preoccupied with making money. It's really hard for me to imagine that he was capable or even interested in changing a diaper. It's really hard to imagine that. Of course, this was pre-plastic diapers,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and the era.
Yeah.
one household working member.
Yeah, so you know, you poop in a cloth diaper and then you gotta deal with it. So it's hard for me to imagine my dad was particularly interested in.
I don't think the moms were either, to be honest.
Yeah, but they had to. Somebody had to do it.
Right.
Yeah, you know, in the last episode I did about this one, you know, I remember my parents having a knockdown, drag-out fight about my dad having an affair when my mom was pregnant. Mm-hmm. So part of what I learned very early on is that men can't be trusted, that they're not faithful, very, very self-centered, which my dad was, and can't really rely on a man to be true and, you know, and keep his promises and be faithful, because I don't think that his affair that he was having with his secretary was his first time being unfaithful to my mom. I don't think he was ever faithful to her.
Did you draw that conclusion about men on your own, or was that just from, did your mom influence that saying anything to you, or was that you just going, uh-oh?
Well, my mom taught me that men are perpetrators.
Okay, and your mom taught you that.
Yes, and that women are victims. Mm-hmm. But my dad also, God, as early as I can remember, his philosophy of life was, you're either a perpetrator or a victim, and you got to figure out which one, because there's no options other than hurting other people and taking advantage of them, or being hurt by other people and being taken advantage by them. So he had a fairly black and white way of looking at the world, and it certainly wasn't very trusting and kind.
Do you think your religion had anything to do with that?
Well, I think the fact that my father was the object of horrible anti-Semitism when he was a kid, to the point where they actually they lived in Canada. My dad was born in Canada. They actually changed their name to get rid of the Steen on Saperstein because it was too Jewish identified. So they called themselves Sapers. So my dad and his two brothers were Sapers. They weren't Saperstein.
Interesting.
My uncles never took back the Saperstein name, although when my parents left Canada, because it said on their passport that they were Sapersteins, not Sapers, we were reintroduced to our last name when I was about 4.5, 5 years old.
Got it.
What I remember about my dad as a really little kid is that he wasn't really around very much. He quit high school as a 14-year-old and to support his family because my grandpa was not capable of making a living.
Wow.
And so he supported his two brothers and his parents from the time he was a, you know, beginning teenager.
Was he the oldest son?
Yeah. I don't know how he did it. 14? I have no idea how a 14-year-old can support.
I don't either.
I know he sold magazines. I know that he was a thief. I know that, you know, he did everything that was necessary in order to keep his family fed and housed. And I think it was pretty sketchy for a long time. My first recollection of seeing my dad in any sort of an emotional way was when I was 4 and his father died. Mm. And I have a really, really clear picture of, we were at a vacation place that we would go to in the summertime in this cabin at a place called Crystal Beach. I can't remember which lake it was on, and, you know, off near Toronto. Mm-hmm. And I remember just seeing my father crying, and it was the first time I'd ever seen him be sad. And I didn't understand what was happening because I was, you know, a little kid. And my mom said, you know, Grandpa died. And I remember seeing my dad crying, and it was really troublesome to me to see him cry because I'd never seen him be emotional like that before. Mm-hmm. And so I went up to him and I said to him, you know, Dad, you don't need to be sad because we have another grandpa. Sure. I didn't really understand what grandpas were, obviously.
I'm sure that made him feel great.
Right. So I'm trying to convince my dad that we only lost one grandpa. There was still another one there. And he just sort of looked at me. And in between crying, you know, he smiled. Mm-hmm. Because my grandpa was a very sweet man.
He was.
Yeah. He was a really kind, super tall. He was like 6'4", this gigantic, tall, you know, Russian-looking guy. Mm-hmm. But he was not a good provider. And so my dad sort of became the patriarch of the family at a very early age, which I think created a lot of desperation.
Yeah. And why? What was the problem with his father? Why wasn't he there to provide?
Well, he came from Poland in the 20s to New York with his twin brother. And in order to be able to marry my grandma, they had to run away from home. I guess she was quite a bit younger than he was. Mm-hmm. So the first thing he did when he got to the United States was join the Texas Rangers, which I know is such a bizarre thing for a Russian Jewish guy. But he actually, I have my aunt has a certificate from the Texas Rangers that my grandpa was a really good sharpshooter. Mm. It's so bizarre that, you know, he's out in Mexico chasing Pancho Villa. Mm-hmm. And then when he got tired of that, he came back to New York and met my grandmother, and they ran away from home because I don't think that my grandmother's parents approved of him because he couldn't make a living. He wasn't educated in any way. He sold food on trains.
Wow.
Yeah, that was his job. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, he wasn't really very good at it. So my dad kind of took over. And then by the time that my dad got married and had kids, he ran an aluminum siding business. I don't know, most people don't even know what aluminum siding is, but back in the 50s, you would cover your house instead of painting it with aluminum siding. Mm-hmm. And somehow he got in trouble with the law, and he was going to go to jail. So we fled the country in a really big hurry. And that was the last time that my parents had seen their parents or any of their relatives.
That was the last time they saw them?
Yeah, until I was an adult.
And so they were how old when they fled?
They must have been somewhere in their early to mid-30s. Which is kind of weird to abandon your family completely.
Yeah.
But he was so scared of going to jail that we just took off. Really, I don't remember a lot about my dad when I'm really young. I remember him once taking me to the emergency room because I got hit in the head with a baseball bat. And he had a Cadillac. He had one of those blue Cadillac convertibles with the giant fins.
Mm-hmm.
And
amazing.
I remember a couple times him taking us in the summer to get ice cream when I was like 3 years old. That sort of thing.
Right.
But I think he was really preoccupied with making money. And what I don't think I really understood at the time is he was also preoccupied with women.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was definitely a narcissist to the full extent.
Okay.
He did not have a conscience to dictate his behavior at all. He really did believe that it was okay to take advantage of people and steal and do whatever you like. Because the world was a really hard place, mm-hmm. and that you had to do everything you needed to survive. And it didn't matter, you know, what you needed to do in order to do that.
Right.
I also remember him watching a lot of crime shows on TV because I think he fancied himself a gangster. I think he really wanted to be a like mm-hmm. in the mob. That would have mm-hmm. been his first choice if he was able to figure out a way to do it, mm-hmm. was to be a gangster. He wasn't a violent person. He never hit me once in my entire life. He was not a violent person, but he loved the idea of getting away with whatever he
yeah.
could.
Was he involved when he was around? Was he involved with you, or?
I would say as a kid, sort of marginally. He was not necessarily very athletic, and he was always probably at least 50 pounds overweight, mm-hmm. and he was only about 5'7". So he was a little guy with a giant belly, mm-hmm. and he was horribly ashamed of his weight. He just hated himself for being fat and could never lose weight ever mm-hmm. in his entire life. So I remember him telling me all the time, it was such a bizarre way to put it, but he'd say, you're either the chicken or the chicken feet, and you got to decide which one you are.
Wow.
And I used to look at him and think, what are you talking about? I'm not a chicken and I'm not chicken feet. I don't know what the hell, you know. It was so, aww. He was just so...
black and white.
Black and white and so certain about the way the yeah. world worked.
Yeah.
And then when we fled Canada and went to Europe, he was on the move trying to figure out how to support his family. And I have to say he was a really smart guy, but he was not educated. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very street smart.
Sounds
so. So he kind of figured out that there was always a way to make a living if you just tried hard enough.
Yeah.
And he had no moral compass, so it didn't matter right. how he did it.
He figured it out.
Yeah, he figured it out. So I wasn't hugely connected to him as a little kid, as a really little kid. Mm-hmm. I remember really missing him and wishing that he would pay more attention to me.
You do remember that?
Yeah. So one of the lies I told myself was that when it comes to my dad, I don't really matter very much. The weird thing is that he was a very affectionate person. He's very soft, but also, at least intellectually, really hard in terms of the way he looked at the world.
That's quite the dichotomy.
It's a really strange combination, because I think that if he had a semi-normal life, he would have been a really sweet, kind-hearted guy. Mm-hmm. But he just never really stood a chance because of yeah. all the anti-Semitism and all the financial poverty.
Yeah,
and
he was just scrapping to survive.
Yeah, he was trying to figure out how to survive.
Yeah.
And so his philosophy matched his survival instinct.
Well, and don't you think some of his weight and overeating was, you know, basically right back to how he felt about himself and the emotions. And,
oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Also, my grandmother, his mom, was truly, I would say, if I could use a clinical diagnosis, fucking batshit crazy. Oof. She was nuts. I know that she molested all three of her children. My middle uncle, by the time he was an adult, weighed about 400 pounds. She dressed him like a girl until he had to go to school because she couldn't tolerate the fact she had no female
children.
So my poor middle uncle, he was a disaster. He made my dad look like a thin man.
Yeah.
In comparison, because you know he was so tweaked by being treated like a girl for the first 5 years of his life.
So you have this crazy woman married to this
sweet old guy who was incompetent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
It's no wonder your dad had some issues.
A few issues. Yeah. So, you know, we ended up in Brazil for a year. I don't remember much of my dad during that period of time. He befriended this guy. I don't know what race the guy was. I'm sure he was Brazilian, but he was a very tall, like gigantic fellow who looked African-American, even though he was Brazilian. Mm-hmm. And they would go off into the Amazon looking for gems and doing all kinds of weird stuff.
Did they find any?
They did. Oh, wow. I have a bowl in my office of all of these semi-precious stones that he found in the Amazon.
That's crazy. And was that how he was trying to make a living?
No, he actually started a coffee exporting business in Brazil to the United States.
That sounds like it would work.
It was. And it did really well until the government was overthrown and we had to flee from Brazil because white people were no longer welcome in Brazil at that time. So my mom actually chose California as the destination. And for whatever reason, my dad agreed to it. Mm. He just said, okay, we can go there.
Mm-hmm. And pretty women.
What's that?
Pretty women in California.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You know, what I remember during that period of time was desperation. My mom was super anxious all the time. Mm-hmm. And my dad was trying to figure out how to support all of us.
And this was, you were just in Brazil for 1 year?
Yeah, we were there for a year.
Okay.
And he was doing actually quite well. And we would have stayed there if the government didn't get overthrown. Because I think he was actually, you know, had a good idea to export coffee from Brazil to the United States. Yeah. But, you know, the government took his business away, so we had to leave. And we ended up in Los Angeles. And my dad was a supreme salesman. Because he had no morals, right? So, you know, he was one of those kind of guys that could sell ice to an Eskimo, right? So I remember that he got a job as a sales manager for the biggest pool company in California. And he was really successful during those years. He was driving around, one of those super fancy Lincolns with suicide doors.
Oh,
and we had a house with a pool. And, and for the 4 or 5 years of elementary school, he was killing it.
And how were the relationship between your mom and dad at that point?
Well, they pretty much hated each other, as far as I could tell.
She didn't, give him a little room to, okay, I'm not so anxious. He's doing well.
No, she never stopped being anxious. Plus, he was not faithful to her, and I think she knew it.
Probably the better he did, the more unfaithful he became.
Yeah, because, there was nothing to stop him from living his, however he wanted to live.
Right.
My dad would call my mom a doughhead, and that was not a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
No, it wasn't a dough like a deer.
Right.
It was a dough like a loaf of bread.
Right. Wow.
About how stupid my mother was.
Wow.
And my mom would just look at him and, tell him he was a fat pig.
Wow.
So I just remember thinking to myself all the time, these people hate each other.
Right.
I don't know what they're doing with each other.
Right.
And I didn't really feel much of a connection to my mom, so I kind of gravitated toward my dad. Mm-hmm. And he took great pleasure in teaching me how not to follow rules.
Well, you are a good learner, I know.
Yes.
I know that from previous conversations.
And it's really sad because what he taught me was that the rules didn't apply to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, that sounds kind of fun, but it wasn't.
Right.
Because, if he ever got mad at me or they were going to punish me, they'd send me to my room. And I didn't have to listen to them, so I'd climb out the window and play with my friends.
Right.
And they'd find me outside, and they wouldn't say anything to me.
They wouldn't.
No.
You wouldn't get in bigger trouble.
It was as though I didn't get punished in the first place, even though I, whatever I was doing was driving them nuts.
Why do you think that was?
Because my dad really liked the fact that I didn't listen to any rules, including his own.
And what about your mom?
She was so ineffective and so victim-oriented that I just thought, she figured, well, why would anybody listen to me? I'm a pathetic victim.
Mm.
So I remember feeling really unloved and very anxious.
Well, probably unsafe if you don't have your parents giving you any sort of boundary and you're doing whatever you want.
Yeah, no boundaries at all.
And
I mean,
they
wanted me to go to school. That was really important to them because in the Jewish tradition, education really matters.
Right.
So they were focused on making sure I showed up at school. But I was super violent, fighting all the time. They had not a single clue. And even if the school, the principal, because I lived in the principal's office, told them that I was, fighting all the time, it didn't even occur to them that there might be a reason for that.
And would you get in trouble for that?
Not by them. But by the principal.
Yeah. So you'd go home and your mom would be like, oh, I got another phone call today. Sit down, have dinner. Okay, let's watch TV.
It was like,
nothing.
And so I remember the only person I really felt any kind of connection to was my dad. So I'd wear his shirts and I'd steal his robe because he had a particular scent that was very recognizable to me. And I wanted to smell him in order to feel some kind of connection to a human being.
Yeah.
Because I was so anxious and I couldn't sleep and I was just a disaster as a kid. I just, my dad was gone doing his thing.
And they didn't see any of this or they didn't care to see any of it.
Well, I first of all, I don't think that there was much psychological sophistication in those days because the way I presented myself, I had tons of friends, super social,
right?
Always had a whole group of friends that I would hang out with and have lots of fun. I was extremely imaginative and I was really good at sports, so I pretty much took care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd wake up in the morning during the summer, get on my bike with my friends, and we wouldn't come home till dark, and they had no idea where I was.
So that's what you were telling yourself. I've got to take care of myself.
Yeah, and I don't matter. Mm-hmm. I really, really, really felt like I didn't matter, mm-hmm. especially to my dad, because my mom did sort of make sure I had clean clothes and food and,
right.
you know, all of that. And my dad, you know, on the weekends would barbecue and because he loved food. Mm-hmm. And so he was always happy to feed the neighborhood. Because it would give him an excuse to, you know, stuff his face. And my mom would go to the store and buy all the food that he couldn't resist. And that's how they kind of did their really bizarre relationship, is that she made sure he stayed fat.
Yeah.
And he just treated her like she was an idiot.
Wow.
So crazy.
Did you ever see any sort of affection between them?
Never.
Nothing.
I don't. Maybe once. Maybe they held hands or whatever. But I really don't think they liked each other very much. And I think my mom just stayed because she had somebody to blame for ruining her life.
Right.
And my dad was off doing his thing.
Right.
I have a very distinct memory when I was like in fifth grade, begging my father to never move again.
Yeah.
Because I hated moving. It was so painful to move. I just hated it.
You would get uprooted in the middle of the night and have to go, right? It wasn't like...
Oh, it was terrible.
This goodbye to the neighbors.
Yeah. So my dad looked me in the eye and he promised me, okay, we'll never move again. And then 2 weeks later, I came home from school and there was a for sale sign in front of my house. And I remember taking a hammer from the garage and just completely destroying this for sale sign.
Yeah.
I was just smashing it and screaming and crying. My dad came outside, you know, what the fuck's wrong with you? What are you doing? And I said, you lied to me. And all he said was, sorry, we're moving this weekend. Mm. It was as though he never even said it.
Wow.
Because in his mind, he, you know, was the king and he got to do whatever he wanted.
Right.
So what he did was walk away from he was making really good money, super successful. And every time he got to the pinnacle of success, he would find a way to completely destroy it. So he quit the job at the pool place and bought a pool company in East Bay of San Francisco. And that's where we moved over a weekend.
Mm.
And it turned out that it was the wettest winter on record.
Oh, gosh.
So here he is trying to buy, you know, trying to sell pools.
Yeah.
And it was a disaster. Oh. Although we lived in a really beautiful house out mm-hmm. in the country. It was really lovely and I got used to it. And I was always really good at making friends. And there happened to be a horse barn close by. So I would ride horses all the time. And my dad loved horses. When I was younger, we used to go to this place called Griffith Park to ride horses. Mm-hmm. So bizarre that my big, giant, you know, fat father would love to jump on a horse and gallop full speed. Felt sorry for the horses, actually. you know, the problem was that because of what happened, he started using money that came from one person's deposit on a pool to build somebody else's, mm-hmm. which was a felony. Mm-hmm. So after about a year and a half in the Bay Area, and I got used to how much, and I loved it, and I made friends, and I was ready to settle, same thing happened. He said to me, we're moving this weekend, just out of the blue. Get
and
your
how
records.
Long were you there?
What's that?
How long were you in the Bay Area?
About a year and a half.
Okay, wow. So you were on the move.
And he was going to go to jail again because he was indicted for like three felonies. And right. So his idea was, well, let's just go back to Los Angeles. So we're living in this beautiful like five-bedroom house and acres of land in the country into a piece of shit apartment building in the middle of the San Fernando Valley. It was so awful.
Wow.
And that's when I started junior high.
And started your spiral.
My career in drugs. Yeah. Yeah. Because it was just so unstable. And my mom was always so nervous. And
I can't say that I blame her.
Yeah. Well, because she had no say in anything. He just did what he wanted.
Yeah.
And so he taught me that, you know, men can't be trusted, including myself, and that, mm-hmm. that I don't matter. And that only thing that matters in his mind is making money. And money was way important than I was. It was quite sad.
It's interesting that you didn't sort of emulate his behavior.
Well, I did. In junior high, I started a life of being a vandal.
But in terms of, I mean, narcissism is more of a, you know, social disease. But that you didn't sort of start living your life as like, okay, I'm the king now. And it's like,
no, I hated myself too much to be a king.
Yeah.
I was so insecure, you know, between my mom and everything that happened with her and my terror of, you know, being lonely all the time and feeling like women would not want nothing to do right. with me. And my dad's absence, I just figured I was an invisible
right.
person.
But except for you saw that that's how he made himself.
Yes.
And yes. so it's interesting that you didn't go, okay, well, this is the key to success. I'm going to be an asshole and rip people off. And
he wasn't, I know this sounds weird, but he didn't act like an asshole toward people mm-hmm. overtly.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually
the con man,
charming in some ways.
Yeah, I bet.
But, you know, I bought my first car selling marijuana
mm-hmm.
and my dad knew.
He did.
I remember once leaving a shopping bag when I was in like 10th grade, a shopping bag full of probably 50 ounce bags of marijuana on my bed. I forgot to put it underneath the floorboards where I kept it.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home from school and it was on my desk.
Wow.
And nobody said a word. And I know my mother found it. I don't think she knew what it was.
Yeah.
And even if she did, you know, I think that my dad was really sort of had a weird sense of pride that his son didn't believe that rules
yeah.
were to be followed, because I would leave my surfboard and my wetsuit by the side of the house. And I had more assemblies than anybody in the history of school, because I would come home in the middle of the day to go surfing if the waves are good. And my dad would come outside, because a lot of times he was working from home. And he would say, oh, another assembly, with a big smile on his face.
Mm-hmm. He and just did not care if you were
He didn't
at school.
Care that I, you know, I actually, when I was in high school, had a friend in print shop print me the necessary print stuff. And I went to, I would break into classrooms all the time and, you know, broke into the office and got a bunch of absence slips. And so I could check myself in and out of school.
Yeah.
By, you know, using my intelligence to work the system.
Yeah, well.
And I never got in trouble. I remember the vice principal came and said to me one day, I know that you're behind all this.
Oh, gosh.
And I just smiled at him and said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I never got in trouble. Never got caught doing anything ever.
But so what happened with your parents where they started it really instilling and believing that education was important and that you needed to go to school? And then fast forward to a few years later, they had just, what, given up? And they're like,
no, because I did well in school.
You did well in school.
Well enough so that.
Yeah. So that's what they cared about. If you got the grades, that's okay. If you didn't show up.
Who cares? Because I passed all my classes and I, you know, I remember I took about some of, I don't even know why I did this. I took a stock class
mm-hmm.
and I asked my dad, what stock should I pick? I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
And I was this long-haired hippie druggie.
Yeah.
And I got the highest return of anybody in the whole class. And the teacher and, you know, all the kids were so mad because, you know, I was a bum.
Right.
Basically. But, you know, my dad was really smart. He knew how to make money.
Yeah.
But he just didn't know how to hold on to it because he didn't believe he deserved it.
Right. And how did you feel about yourself during this time?
Was miserable.
You were.
But I was so lonely. And I knew that I was really different than everybody else, being a really highly sensitive person, but I had no idea why that was happening.
Mm.
So really, I didn't feel like I mattered because I didn't in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And I had horrible nightmares and I couldn't sleep. I remember I would spend hours rocking myself in bed like a autistic kid, just trying to get my nervous system to calm down because I would have such vivid, horrible nightmares.
Mm.
I can still remember so many nightmares I had as a kid. They're
That's
so clear
crazy.
In my head because of all the instability, you know, when I saw people being killed in Brazil and I got run over by a truck and I just never, you know, knew what was going to happen next because my family was so unstable. I will say that there were positive parts to it. My parents loved baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So for a year they had actually season tickets to Dodger Stadium. And so I saw a ton of baseball games.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my parents would take us out of school and we'd go to the...
Probably the best memories of your life.
Right? It was really fun.
Yeah.
I actually got to see the World Series.
Yeah.
In 1966, where two of the most famous pitchers that ever pitched were... And I just like, wow, this is amazing.
Dad, you're great.
Because my parents, both of them, love baseball.
That's so
funny.
So
that was fun.
Yeah.
That was one thing they actually kind of, I don't think they bonded with each other, but they both really liked it.
Yeah.
So that was kind of fun.
But they had, when you were, you know, rocking yourself to sleep and being sad, they really had no idea what was going on with
you. Well, I never said anything. I just thought, you know, it was normal to be a mess.
Yeah.
And I don't think my mom noticed anything. And my dad was really not home most of the time.
And you never broke down. You never was just like, I, what is happening to me? What is going on?
In elementary school, I was too busy fighting. Mm-hmm. And in junior high and high school, I was too busy getting high.
Yeah.
Because, well, I mean, from morning till night, I smoked pot from the moment I would wake up until I would go to sleep at night, every single day. And, you know, I would come home high and it was very obvious, you know, and my parents would wait up for me. My dad wouldn't say anything. And my mom would say something like, where do you get the needles to inject that stuff?
Oh, gosh.
And I'm thinking to myself, my parents are fucking idiots, Lewis. Right? I would say to my mom, you know that you don't use a syringe in order to get high on marijuana. Well, I don't know what you do, but I just don't know where you get the syringes. And I'm thinking to myself, I wouldn't put a syringe in my body for anything, right? So how do you take people like that seriously when they're so ignorant?
And,
you know, plus I could just feel the how much they really did not respect and love each other. It was so obvious.
It's terrible.
It was just awful. And when they finally got a divorce, I thought, you know, this should have happened years and years ago.
Just a sidebar for a second. What do you think about parents that or couples that are together that are not happy and they're like, oh, well, we're staying together for the kids. Like, do you think that's a recipe in disaster? Or do you think that, well, that's fine. That's more helpful for the kids. And then do what you need to do when they're out of the house or later, whatever. I hear that come up so often.
Well, you know, my reference point is of being a really highly sensitive kid. And so nobody was fooling me about how much pain there was and how much they hated each other.
You think you would have been better off if they would have split when you were a kid?
You know, I'm not really sure. All I heard was my mom endlessly complaining about what a dick my dad was. Always, you know, he's done this and he doesn't do, you know, everything was about him victimizing her.
Yeah.
And what I heard from him about her was that she was just an idiot. So, you know,
gosh,
no reason to respect her. But they stayed together for 23 years, which is stunning.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's just so weird. But, you know, I think they were bonded in pain more than anything. Mm-hmm. And so the lies I would tell myself were based on abandoned, and, you know, I got sexually abused, but I didn't remember that. They never hit me. My dad almost hit me once, which is such a bizarre concept. I remember him chasing me around the house because I did something to get him mad, and I ended up cowering on the floor in the kitchen, and he had his hand up ready to hit me, and we just locked eyes,
and he stopped.
He didn't hit me. He started crying and looked. Wow. And I think he just thought, I can't hit this kid.
Wow.
And so he just stopped and he walked away. And I was relieved because I thought he was going to kill me.
Yeah.
Because I
yeah.
was a pretty provocative kid.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that I was ever innocent.
Right.
Because if I could push, I would push. And if I could push harder, I would push as hard as I could. Because I really like getting reactions out
right.
of it. You know.
You needed to.
And he loved the fact that I was a smart ass and that I had no respect. Because he thought most people were stupid and that they deserved to be taken advantage of. So I had no self-discipline at all. I had no idea that I had a brain that worked because I wasn't, you know, I was never held accountable for anything.
And what about your siblings?
My little brother always was somebody who sat back and watched. And he watched my sister and I be incredibly rebellious.
Your sister also.
She was such an angry, bitter person because I think my dad actually molested her when she was a little kid. I would never want to be a woman in my father's life because he had no respect for women at all. He just thought they were stupid, you know,
that's so terrible.
Whatever. And so he ruined my sister for life. She started smoking at around 12 or 13 and died from lung cancer by the time she was 50 because she just couldn't.
Yeah.
And she would abuse alcohol a bit and She was just a really sad, really depressed person.
So sad.
And I think that was a lot to do with my dad and a certain amount to do with my mom. Because mm-hmm. my mom didn't protect her, right. obviously. So my sister and I, and we really didn't hang out much as children because I was doing my thing with my friends and she had her friends and all of that. And I used to torture my brother for wanting my attention because he wanted me to be the dad that he didn't have.
Yeah.
Because if my dad was absent from me, he was completely absent from my brother.
He was.
Yeah, because my brother had nothing to offer him in terms of rebellion.
Yeah.
My brother was eager to please. And so, you know, I felt sorry for him because every classroom that he went to, you know, the teacher would say, please tell me that you don't have an older brother and sister, right? Because Saperstein was not a very common name.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he had to start every class in junior high and high school.
Yeah.
With teachers like, oh, fuck, not another Saperstein.
He's like, no, my role is a peacemaker in the family.
That's right.
I'm not the rebellious one.
So, you know, luckily he was not a rebellious person.
Yeah.
I will say that, I know I'm skipping ahead a bit, for the last maybe 15 years of my father's life, my brother and my sister absolutely had nothing to do with him. No contact at all. And my daughter, from the time she was about 2.5, I was terrified of my father. She had nothing to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily I was smart enough not to, you know, how some parents force their mm-hmm. kids. Oh, you go say hi to grandpa or go hug him. I just thought, you know, she's smarter than she realizes.
Yeah.
Because if I was a girl, I wouldn't go near my dad either.
Yeah, that's got to be because
he was creepy and dishonest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he and I just had a connection that at least it felt to me like I had one parent in a certain way.
Yeah.
Because he really wanted me to get an education. He paid for my whole education all the way through getting a PhD. And even though I'm not sure he understood what I got a degree in, he was, you know, proud. The only time I ever saw my parents united was in forcing me to go to Hebrew school.
Yes.
Which was, I think to myself, how fucked up is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Of all the things.
Out of all the things, right? Because they made me feel so ashamed of myself that I didn't want to do it. I just hated it. It was, to me, so offensive to go to temple with my dad. Because we would sit in the temple, and he was a really loud snorer. And as soon as he sat down in the chair, he'd start snoring. And everybody in the whole congregation, look at this guy just snoring away.
And
I'm so embarrassed, right? And I didn't understand why it mattered to them.
Yeah. Because he's sitting there sleeping.
Uh-huh.
Is your mom like nudging him, like, wake up?
No, she wasn't there.
Okay.
They specifically chose where we lived to be around Jewish people in order to feel safe. And I never really understood because I never experienced anti-Semitism as a kid. Because I was surrounded by Jews all the time.
Right.
So there was nothing to be afraid of.
Right.
So it was a complicated situation because, you know, being around my kids and watching them grow up, I mean, I would pay attention to every breath they took.
Yeah.
So it was so hard for me to imagine that I could be so neglected.
It's so, I feel the same with my kids. Like you look back and you're like, this is why I'm put on this earth.
Yeah.
Like, there is nothing better. And then you just don't understand how parents, and even just not the neglect, but I mean, I have so many friends that just, they'll say, oh, are you guys going on vacation? We'll be like, they're like, with your kids?
They
just don't
understand. Why would you do that?
And I mean, I have so many friends that like, they go on all these trips and vacations and whatever. And like, they never take their kids.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, okay, now their kids are gone. And now what? They're gone. And the times that you get to see them are limited because they don't live in your house anymore.
It's funny that you mention this because at lunch today, my wife said to me, my daughter's 39, I think, 38 or 39. She'll be 39 later this year. And she said to my wife this morning, we have to go on a family vacation this year. She only wants to go on vacation with her family.
Yeah.
And
that's so nice.
I understand that part of it's because dad pays for everything. But the other part of it is that she just loves being around us.
Yeah.
And my son does too. It's really very sweet.
That's the only thing you can ask for and hope for, right?
Yeah. The other cool thing that my dad did for me that I will never forget is that one day when I was about 13 years old, He came home from work and he had two brand new surfboards in his, sticking out of the trunk of his car. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, where did those come from? And he said, well, he at that time he was working for a franchise company that was like a fish and chips kind of a place. Because he thought somehow that that was going to make money, which it never did. But one of the women that was the investors, he went to, you know, when I look back at it now, they were probably having an affair or whatever. But her son went to Vietnam. He bought two brand new surfboards and went to Vietnam and died.
Oh, my
gosh. And so this woman had these surfboards in her garage. And so she said to my dad, do you think that your kids would enjoy these? And so he gave her two brand new, she gave him two brand new surfboards and he brought them home. And that was like a miracle. Changed my life. I just fell so in love.
And had you been surfing up to this point or was this your intro?
I was riding a rafter.
Yeah.
You know, back in those days, they had these canvas rafts that would, you know, tear your stomach apart because they were, you know, they weren't user friendly. I always loved the ocean.
Yeah.
But, you know, these surfboards are too big for one of us to carry on our own. But, you know, so now all of my friends and I would start surfing all the time.
Wow.
And it was the best. I absolutely credit my dad with starting me off in my surfing career because it was such a lovely gift.
Yeah.
He had no idea what he was doing. Not a clue. That was really sweet. You know, interspersed in those moments were neglect and lots of pain.
But it's nice you can pull out the there were a few memories and, you know, the fact that he stopped from punching you in the face.
Yes.
I mean, there was a heart there.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. My dad would, and this was a long time ago, if there was a homeless person that he felt sad for, he'd give the person like $20.
Yeah.
And this was when $20 was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So he definitely had a heart.
Yeah.
It's just that he came from such horrible circumstances that he never really stood a chance.
Right.
In any significant way. And then when I was about 17, they got into therapy, my parents, because it was brand new in Los Angeles.
Why do you think they got into it?
Oh, because they knew that they were fucked up. They knew that.
Did they know that?
They knew that they were a mess. So they both started doing marriage counseling or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And they knew I was a mess because I was so depressed and high all the time. And so one day they said to me, hey, there's this guy we met. We really like him. He's Jewish, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Which mattered more than anything. So we think that you would really benefit by talking to this guy. And again, they did me such a huge favor because it started my healing process when I was about 17 and a half.
What about your siblings?
I don't think that my parents were as worried about them. Mm-hmm. My sister was always super angry with my dad, and so I don't think she would have done anything he said.
Right.
And my mom was, you know, so passive that didn't stand a chance in that regard. But for some weird reason, I said, okay, I'll do it. And I remember just being blown away by this idea that I had feelings and underneath and I just completely gave up getting high, like overnight.
So just tell me a little bit about like those first couple sessions.
Well, somebody was actually willing to listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was so weird that somebody actually cared enough.
Did you even know how to talk and how to open up? And
he would just ask me questions and I would start talking about my life. And then I realized how sad and angry I was, that I was just enraged all the time by all the horrible things that happened and didn't happen and how lonely I was and how scared, you know, all of that. So it began a transformation. I just stopped getting high and it was pretty amazing actually.
And did the transformation come because you finally were allowed to sort of bring voice to these feelings, or uh-huh, was he really helpful in like, Dana, this is fucked up, what's happening to you?
I don't know if he was that direct. It was more being able to talk to someone,
mm-hmm,
and being able to talk about how sad and angry and how bad I felt about myself.
Yeah.
And my dad paid for it. It was really lovely that he was willing to support my healing in that way.
Yeah.
So, and then I started having conversations with my parents, mm-hmm, about how I felt and how neglected I felt and how angry I was about things that happened and didn't happen. And amazingly enough, my dad took responsibility.
Wow.
And he tried to apologize, for being absent. And we started spending a bit more time together, and it brought us a bit closer, as close as you can get to a narcissist, mm-hmm. which is not that close, but you know. And my mom never gave up her flag of victimization. So I don't know if the therapy helped her very much.
Did they continue to go also?
I think so for a while, but then I graduated high school and moved away. Mm-hmm. That was really important. I couldn't wait to get away.
Yeah.
Well. Because at that same time, summer around that time, well, I left home and moved to San Diego to go to college so I could surf, mm-hmm. obviously.
Priorities.
And the cool thing was that my parents continued to support me while going to school and paid for therapy for me. So I never stopped being in therapy from the time I was 18 until probably close to 30.
Did they ever say, Dana, we see a change in you, or what you're doing is working?
No, they were just really happy that I got some kind of, well, because then I went to junior college and I had no idea that a brain existed in my head. Mm. Because even though I did really well in school, I never tried. Mm-hmm. It was easy for me. I have a good memory. My parents had no idea that I couldn't spell and that I had dyslexia because I reversed numbers and letters. Mm-hmm. But it never became visible because my memory was so good that I would study for a spelling test and get an A on the test. Yeah. And then if you ask me how to spell the word the following week, there's no way. I had no idea. But at least for the short term, I was able to fool everybody that I didn't have a problem.
And did your friends in college know you were in therapy? Was that?
I didn't really tell anybody. I was kind of ashamed of it in a certain way because it wasn't something that was mainstream at that time.
Right.
So I don't think my friends knew how much I was suffering. I never really talked to anybody about how lonely I was. All of my friends had girlfriends and, you know, I was friends with their girlfriends, but I just could not get past my self-conscious shyness for a really long time.
Yeah.
And it was only when I quit school to move to Hawaii to go surfing that my parents had a heart attack because they were terrified I would never come home and never go back to school.
I can understand that.
Yeah. Even though I said to them, I'm not going away forever. I just want to go have an adventure. And then when I met my wife in Hawaii, it was the first time that my father didn't care that the person I was going out with wasn't Jewish.
Oh, wow.
Cause he would always ask me if I ever had a date, is she Jewish? Right. Uh-huh. Cause it's all that mattered to them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in this situation, because I was, going to come back and finish my education, they wanted to know that she would be supportive of me in school.
Got it.
So they didn't really care what religion she might be.
Right.
It was, don't let this girl fuck up your school education.
Yeah.
So, and then when I came home from Hawaii, my parents then were in the process of getting a divorce. So I remember being in their house and my dad again was having another affair with a woman that he ended up marrying. And I don't know what they were thinking. Because I was at the house alone. My sister had already moved out and my brother was in college. And I was just sitting there listening to them screaming at each other at the top of their lungs. And my dad continued to lie to her. You're crazy. I don't know what you're talking about. I know that you're fucking this. You know, it was so awful to hear them going after each other with such vehemence and vengeance. It's like.
And they just didn't care that you were there.
I think they were so involved in their own hating everything. Mm. It was awful.
They're probably trying to prove to you subconsciously that they were the ones that were in the right.
You know, I don't think any of it had to do with me. I think they were so lost in their own hate and it finally just came forward. So then my parents got a divorce and my dad remarried. And he found a woman who was actually from Iran, living in England. So she was a Christian, not a Muslim, but from such a different culture.
Yes.
And I was like, what planet did my dad land in?
Yeah.
Because she had this huge family in Los Angeles of all of these Persian people. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is just too weird for me to handle. Mm-hmm. And my mom was, you know, still married to my dad. She never got divorced from my dad. And so, you know, all she could do was complain endlessly about, you know, the fact that he left her and so on and so forth. But my dad found a woman that was happy to engage in his criminal enterprise with him. And my dad had had enough therapy at this time to where he didn't destroy the goodness. And so he became fabulously wealthy. He and his wife spent maybe 10, 15 years or more just making so much money. It's ridiculous.
In something legitimate?
It was white collar criminal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a criminal enterprise. And they were so good at it.
Both of them.
Yeah, they did it together.
She was down for that too. Okay.
Well, they started a bank in England that had no assets, and they would sell bank guarantees to desperate people who needed money to all around the world that wanted to, you know, monetize their business. And the weirdest thing was, is my dad would tell these people that nobody had ever used one of the bank guarantees. They were basically useless. Nobody ever used one. And that he didn't expect that they would be able to either. So he basically told them that he was stealing money from them. But they did it anyway. And they would give him hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was so crazy how he would record the conversations to, you know, be able to protect himself.
Yeah.
That he would tell these people that he was selling them something that couldn't be used.
I don't understand.
People still bought it. They were so desperate that they just didn't listen to him. They were so greedy. Right?
Wow.
So I remember once going to his house. This was before TSA.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me his overcoat.
Mm-hmm.
He opened up his overcoat and he had pockets sewn into the overcoat. And each pocket contained giant packets of $100 bills.
Wow.
Just thousands and thousands of dollars that he was going to fly from Los Angeles to London to bring the money overseas so he didn't have to pay taxes on it.
Yeah.
I don't even know how he wore this thing. It probably weighed 100 pounds. And he was so proud of himself. And I'm like, wow, my dad just is so different than my friend's dad's.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But and not ashamed. Like he thought it was a
not at all.
Thing
he was so happy that he devised this way of taking money out of the country so he didn't have to pay taxes on it. And he was so proud to show it to me. And, you know, I didn't say anything because I just thought, okay, more power to you.
And did he ever feel bad? Did he ever come clean in his own consciousness about like, oh, I haven't been very nice to people?
No, because he felt that he was justified because he told them the truth, that he was selling people worthless paper and they still bought it anyway. And so he would just say to me, you have no idea how stupid people are.
Back to that.
Right? Not after that, all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, he just thought people were the stupidest, that most people were just idiots.
Yeah.
And he, you know, his idea was if you can't figure out a way to get rich in the United States, there's something really wrong with you.
Wow.
Now, he was white, so that helped.
Yeah.
But from that point forward, he just amassed tons of money.
And then did he finally retire or what ended up happening?
Part of what happened was that he got cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He got leukemia. He got really sick. So he went into USC Medical Center. And he got a hold of the board and he said, if you guys cure me, I will give you an endowment of $10 million. And my dad's a good salesman.
Yeah.
So they gave him a private suite in the hospital and they had the best round-the-clock treatment you could ever imagine. So they cured him of cancer. And then they came with their hands out looking for the money. And he looked at them and he said, I don't know what you guys are talking about. I don't have any money to give you.
Oh,
it was a scam. He played another, you know, his name was Harold, another Harold scam.
Yeah.
He was so proud of himself.
Oh, my God.
For scamming USC Medical Center out of hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical treatment.
Oh.
Because they thought he would play on people's greed.
Right.
And he knew that, you know, he'd get away with it because he was super charming.
Yeah.
And his wife was so happy they didn't have any medical bills.
Right.
And, you know, it was all good.
Jeez.
I had a half brother that they had, and he's just a few years older than my kids. He's a really lovely person, and my kids are super connected to him.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, but I never really gone on with his mom. You know, having a theoretical stepmother who's only 3 years or 4 years older than you was just weird.
Mm-hmm.
It was just weird.
Yeah, is she still in Los Angeles?
Yeah, yeah.
But you'd never see her or anything.
I haven't spoken to her since the day of my dad's funeral, probably 15 years ago.
Yeah.
She sadly got assaulted in London and left for dead on the streets of London by these three African guys that just about killed her. So I don't think she ever recovered from that assault.
Yeah.
It's a really terrible situation. And I think my dad was pretty much unfaithful to her during their whole marriage, too. But according to what my brother has told me, that it's not unusual in the Persian culture for men to have affairs. It's just sort of okayed.
Got it.
And I don't know if she was okay with it or not, but.
Didn't matter anyway.
What's that?
It didn't matter anyway.
Yeah. And eventually he got dementia, like really bad dementia. I think some of it was from the chemo, you know, from his cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. So for the last 5 or 6 years of his life, his wife would not even tell me where he was. She wouldn't let me see him because I don't know what her worry was. I think she was worried I might come after them for money or whatever. And at his funeral, she brought her lawyer because she thought I was going to do something. Because when my dad died, he didn't leave any money to my brother and I. And my sister had already died, but my dad didn't know that because we never told my dad that she died of cancer.
Wow.
Because he was demented and he probably wouldn't have known anyway.
And so you didn't see in the last like 5 or 6 years of his life?
Not until 2 days before he died. His mom was somewhere. I think she was in England, his wife. And so my brother called me and said, hey, I don't think that our dad is doing very well. So if you want to come see him before he dies, you better. And so my son and I actually drove down to Los Angeles where he was. And he was pretty much comatose, laying in his bed. And I could tell he was on death's door. Mm-hmm. But the weirdest thing is that he opened his eyes for a minute. Not for a minute, for like 10 seconds and looked at us and smiled. And that was so sweet to get that acknowledgement at the very end of his life that he knew we were there and he was, you know, saying goodbye. It was, you know, it was sad. I felt bad. But I was also kind of estranged from him in a certain way because I hadn't seen him for years. Mm-hmm. My brother and sister had nothing to do with him. I was surprised that my brother even came to the funeral because he really, really didn't like my dad at all. So, you know, mostly what I learned from him in learn to lie to myself about is, number one, I don't matter. Right. And that there's no reason to obey laws. And that, you know, the rules don't apply to people that are smart.
Yeah.
It's only for the stupid people in the world. Yeah. So learning discipline was really hard for me.
I can imagine.
But luckily, when I discovered I had a brain, which was when I was about 18 and started college, and I started to apply myself and wanted to learn. I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. My brain actually works. I had no idea that this thing inside my head was good for anything other than drugs, right? And luckily, I didn't mess it up so badly that it still worked. But I will say that my first class that I had at college, I had a really famous journalism teacher in a writing class. And he was really nice to me. I think there was something about me that he liked. And he said, you know, if you do all the assignments I'll give you today, because I think you're really a smart guy. But I never believed that rules applied to me. So I did 9 out of the 10 assignments and I got a B. And I went back to him and I said, how dare you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what the fuck is wrong with you? I thought you were my friend, right? Mm-hmm.
He said, not my father.
I said, I told you, if you didn't do what was required of you, that I wouldn't give you an A.
Yeah.
That was the first time in my life that the rules actually applied.
There was a consequence.
And I remember thinking to myself, wow.
This is how this works.
This is a miracle. There are actually people who keep their word.
Yeah, or are paying attention to me.
Yeah, and it changed my life.
I'll never forget this guy.
Yeah.
Did that really change your life? Were you like, okay.
Yeah, I started actually following some school rules.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, I stopped cheating and, you know. I got through high school cheating, basically.
Yep. Well, he really instilled from the beginning to you, where like there was no question about the way that you were lying to yourself about the rules not applying,
yes.
And you're outside of the law and all of that stuff.
But I have to say, looking back on my life, when I moved to Santa Barbara, I found a therapist that adopted me in a certain way. And I spent about a decade in therapy with him. And he taught me what it felt like to be loved by a man. Mm-hmm. And he really encouraged me to become a therapist. He's the one that told me that I had what it took and that he would do anything to help me. And he went so far beyond what a psychologist would normally do.
Yeah.
And I am forever grateful to this man. Yeah. He was just so loving and so lovely. And I don't think my marriage with my wife would have worked out if it wasn't for him. He just was devoted and kind and...
He saw you.
He did. And it was so sweet. And then when I finished graduate school, I was told in school every day, there's no way to make a living in Santa Barbara as a therapist. There are too many therapists here. This was in 1987 or 8, something like that. And so I actually thought about moving away because I was brainwashed into believing there was no hope. And I got in a car accident, and it wasn't a bad accident, but I got some treatment in Montecito at a doctor's office, and on the massage table, and I'm looking around, and I say to the massage person, this is the most beautiful office I have ever seen in my life. I would love to work in a place like this. Well, unbeknownst to me, they were looking for a psychologist to join their practice.
My goodness.
So she tells the doctor, you know, there's this nice man that I met. He wants a, you know, he couldn't speak highly enough about this place. And so this man, Alan Tomaszewski, was my doctor. And he said, well, let's get together and you can meet my wife and, you know, maybe you can join us. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. So the most amazing thing happened that, you know, I got through the admission process. The problem was that my wife and I were like dirt poor, barely able to pay our mortgage. And the office rent that he wanted was triple my mortgage.
Oh, gosh.
It was the highest that I didn't even know anybody could charge that money, that much money for such a small. But I just thought to myself, you know, there's something about this that is really special.
Yeah, it's supposed to happen.
So despite the fact that I couldn't afford it, I did it. And within 6 months, he helped me launch my practice. We became best friends and have been best friends ever since then.
Wow.
And he's another man who's about 10 years older than me, and he was just so inspirational.
Oh.
And so lovely toward me. So somehow men have shown up in my
right
in my life at really critical moments to help me.
Thank goodness, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a big plan.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, if you met my wife, you would wonder, what is this woman doing with this man? Because she's so lovely. So despite all the shitty stuff that happened, I just found the best people yeah. to be a part of my life. Yeah. It's so sweet. It's really, really nice. So, you know, I say all of this because I want people to know that there's hope.
Right.
And if you work hard enough on the lies you tell yourself, I don't lie to myself in these ways anymore. I don't think I'm an unlovable person. And I mean, I'm too old to consider whether I'm attractive or not, but it doesn't matter because I've been married for a million years and my wife is at least willing to put up with the way I look. So that part doesn't matter. You know, so a lot of that stuff has, you know, been resolved. And you know, beside the fact that I'm a feeble physical specimen, that I'm handicapable, as they say, my life is amazing.
How do people sort of recognize if they are telling themselves lies?
Well, if you tell yourself that you're not lovable, if you say mean things to yourself, if you criticize yourself, if you shame yourself, those are all lies because it's just not true. Those are things that happened to you or didn't happen for you, and they don't represent who you are. Right? It's not my fault I got molested. It's not my fault my parents were really messed up people. Right. I didn't do anything to, you know, cause that. I'm not saying I was the easiest person to have as a kid, but mostly it was because I was so scared and overwhelmed all the time. Mm-hmm. So I want people to know that, you know, you're lying to yourself when you tell yourself that you're not worthy of being loved.
Yeah.
And that you don't matter. And that, you know, you're going to spend the rest of your life alone or and that there's no hope of whatever. Because, you know, you and I both know that if you work hard enough on healing the stuff that has harmed you, that you can find a way past it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously therapy is how you go about healing this stuff. And
well, for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some other ways? What if someone doesn't have access to a therapist or can't afford a therapist? Like, what would you suggest someone does?
Well, you know, I don't know how to answer that question because I don't think you can do therapy on yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you can do it to a certain degree, mm-hmm. but there's no such thing as not being able to afford therapy because there are tons of therapists in training. Some of them are really good and they don't charge hardly anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm not convinced that it's impossible to get help.
So the first sign is really like just talking negatively to yourself and like, no, that's not fair.
Look, if we were held accountable, I know I've said this a million times, for how we talk to ourselves, we'd all be in jail for assault.
Yeah.
Because we're not nice to ourselves.
Right.
Right? I can't even tell you how often when I forget something or I walking from one room to the next, and I think to myself, what did I come in here for? I think, God, Dan, you're such an idiot. Well, if my wife said to me, God, Dan, you're such an idiot, I'd be pissed. Mm-hmm. But I'm allowed to say it to myself because, you know, somehow it's okay for me to insult myself.
Right.
And it's not.
Yeah, no, we're toughest on ourselves, I think.
Right, because again, we're not our trauma.
Right.
Those things have affected us, obviously, but they can be healed.
Yeah.
So, I'm sticking with it.
I think it's worked. You've come a long way, baby, just like that commercial said.
Well, I'm really happy about that part.
Yeah.
Right? It helps to have faith and to keep trying.
And do the work. I mean, this stuff is not...
No substitute.
Easy.
Yes. And the people I see in my practice are my heroes.
Yeah.
And I say that, right? They're my heroes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people know I don't mess around as a therapist. And so if you come here, you got to expect, you know, to sometimes have a tough go of it, but there's purpose to it.
And it's not linear. I feel like, oh, right, I got this all figured out. And then I just get sidelined with something else.
Of course.
But yeah, it's important.
So I really appreciate you listening to me babble on here today.
Aww, it's nice to hear about your
life. Always so kind to me, and I enjoy our conversations.
Me too.
So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.